Hello and welcome to Leaning Into Light's monthly conversation. This month we are talking about a youthful light on things. And I have special guest Sage Mace with me. Welcome, Sage.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
So good to have you. So welcome to our listeners. And yes, Sage is with us. And this is one of our free monthly recordings to support you, our listeners, to lean into light. What does that mean? Leaning into light means something that all of us need to do to have a good life. And that means basically recovering, to choose light, to choose joy, to choose love every time we feel down, to return to feeling, you know, the positive stuff in life. So this is one of our gifts to support you. So grab a pen, pause if you need to, take notes. When you take notes, it is 70% more likely that thing will happen or that thing will stick with you. So the pen and the paper are positive things. And yeah, a little bit on Sage. So Sage Mace, recently you graduated from Sir Francis Drake High School in 2013. The name is being changed soon. You said 2017, actually, Sage. Mm-hmm. That's right. The name of the high school. Sage, you went to Westmont College for a year and you're transferring to USF. You identify.
Yes, I did.
Yes. You identify as an activist and a growing educator, and art has always been a big part of you. And how we met, Sage is my, are you my niece? I mean, kind of. You're my daughter.
Yes. To me, you're DT Jessica. So something family.
Family. And basically we come from a wonderful family, mostly Puerto Rican. And, you know, you just, you know, it's real blunt for me. You really are a lovely human being. You stand out, you're engaged, and I'm just honored that you're part of my family and I wanted to interview you. So that's why.
Thank you.
Yeah. So Sage, you have a big sister who is also lovely, Julia, mm-hmm. and two really wonderful, wonderful parents, dedicated, mm-hmm. committed parents. You were raised just north of San Francisco in a town called Corte Madera, and you have been raised Christian and you remain Christian. Is that so?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
just a moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm having a Krista Tippett moment here for those listeners who listen to On Being podcast. Krista Tippett always starts with this question. I am not going to transfer to start with this question every time. However, for you, Sage, I want to ask, tell us a little bit about the spiritual or religious kind of fabric of your childhood. How did that look for you?
Of course. So I was raised in Corte Madera, and it's actually a place where Christianity isn't that popular. It's very liberal, also very affluent, and it is a suburbia. And so I was actually growing up, I was a little bit of an outlier having this Christian background. And so it definitely, the most like influential figure with me coming into my faith was my abuela, Irma. And everyone who knows her, everyone, to emphasize, just testifies to how much joy she carries herself with. Mm. And it touches everyone that she engages with. So if you see Irma, like, you know Christ's joy and you know his love, because that's like simply her standard of living. Mm. And so I think it was really her, which was when I was little, was like the greatest testament to Christ's love, just through how she lives, followed by my abuelo. And it's so sweet because that's another thing to note in Corte Madera, that of course there's many close families, but a lot of my friends that I engage with, their culture is more individualistic. And so coming from this like Puerto Rican background, which is also like religious, it means living in community, which is something I always knew, because my abuelo and abuela, they would pick me up every single Wednesday and we would go on a date and they would drive all the way from Sonoma. And so in that time spent together, we'd always like sing songs. They would share scripture with us. And they would simply just be in community with us as like mentors and our family members, and whatnot. So that was really like my first introduction to faith. Mm-hmm. And I really do say that before the church, because they're an integral like part of my life. And then with that, I would go to church every Sunday with my mom and my dad and my sister. And that also helped to establish my identity in Christ, but also as an activist grounded in radical love. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely been lifelong, this like journey and my faith and how these different people have nurtured that in me.
Mm, beautiful. Yes. And I mm-hmm. do know your abuela, as you call her, which is short for abuela, right? In mm-hmm. Spanish. And yeah, she is a very deeply loving person. So beautiful mm-hmm. to be impressioned. You mentioned Sage radical love, which this has always been your grounding point. What does this mean? What does radical love mean to you?
Yeah, of course. So to break it down, especially within the framework of my faith, which is integral to me. So I think like the biggest act of radical love that you see in the Bible was with Jesus, because he moved within this space of love and it brought him to the point where he died on the cross for our sins. And for everyone so that we could live and then have heaven. So that was kind of like my first lesson, like taught of what radical love looks like. Mm-hmm. And that's nothing light, because it's literally this aspect of death for radical love. And so then with that, in like my studies and studying different people who I look up to and have taken note of, in my journey as like a growing educator, one of them, of course, that comes to mind is Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do know him, but especially now we have a day that honors him, but oftentimes who he is whitewashed and diminished down. And so when I was like studying him, it's so clear how he like moved in love without fear. And there's this one quote, and it's not an exact quote, but he was essentially like, I would rather be dead than to live in fear, which is bound to this idea of love. And he abided by that. And for it, during his time, the FBI labeled him as one of the most like dangerous men in America. White Christians as well as Black Christians barred him from preaching at churches. He was called like an N-word password. Pastor. And so he had all these like labels thrown upon him just because his idea of love was so radical and how it brought people together and how it called into everyone to sit at the table. Mm. So it really connected people across class, across race, and across religion. Mm. So I think radical love, in its sense, it's something that moves you into a space of action. And then with that calls everyone to do the same.
Mm, yeah. So very brave, very courageous, staying Catholic, loving. And yeah, I mean, just a few days ago, I was listening to I Have a Dream, this speech by him with mm-hmm. his voice with my 7-year-old daughter in the car. And yeah, he doesn't sit there and talk badly about people. He just says, you know, this is what we want for our children, and feels it so deep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So for you, you bring that spirit with you as best as you can.
Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your current, how your life looks currently, just to give people a little picture. So you do care mm-hmm. of your grandma, your dad's mom.
Mm-hmm.
And you work for an organization, and this sounds really fun, Acción Latina in San mm-hmm. Francisco. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, of course. So Acción Latina is a nonprofit in the city, and we specifically focus on the empowerment of the Latino community through arts and media.
Mm.
So specifically what that entails is we have this amazing newspaper, and it's actually the longest running bilingual paper in California. Mm. And it's called El Tecolote. So for everyone listening, I would definitely recommend you guys looking it up. And so how it started is also a really amazing story, because it was in the 70s, and students at San Francisco State they realized that there wasn't that much representation for Black and Brown people in newspapers. And so with that, they were like, we're going to take this upon ourselves to create the representation that we want to see so that we can tell our truths rather than it being told for us. Mm. And so from that, El Tecolote formed, and now it's volunteer run, which is also incredible because it's just a testament to like the love and community that people are writing and continuously submitting to our bi-monthly paper. So that's one aspect of the work I do.
Yeah, super, super. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the website and it looks phenomenal.
Yeah. And then we also have an in-house gallery, which I'm always so honored to help with in any little way, shape, or form. Because we always center amazing works. And again, we do try to focus on people of color, as there's limited representation in galleries across America of people of color's works. So it's this incredible space where you're able to see a full body of works by different people. Mm. So that's another awesome part. Yeah. So we do many, many things, and I'm always happy to help in any way for Acción Latina.
Wonderful. Yeah. We will share the URL after the call, but can you share it now just in case somebody's going to climb off the call sometime soon?
Oh yeah, of course. So I don't know it off of the top of my head, but I believe it's axionlatina.org.
Yes.
And I'll type it in right now.
Yeah.
To double check.
Yeah. They won't see that. It's axionlatina.org, and Acción is A-C-C-I-O-N, and then Latina.org. So wonderful with your work there. I love it.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Beautiful. And then you also do some community garden work in Marin City, which is just south of you on the way into San Francisco. Tell us about that.
Yeah, of course. So that's actually a really long story, how it unfolds. But so how it began is for El Tecolote, I oftentimes write as a little portion of my job on the side. Mm-hmm. And so I caught wind of the fact that there was going to be a desegregation mandate for the Sausalito District. And so under the Sausalito District, there's the Willow Creek Charter School and then the Martin Luther King Jr. Academy, which is where the community garden is at. And so at this time, this was a year ago when the mandate was made for desegregation to occur. I started looking through like the history of the two schools, and it was really clear how the segregation was taking place in terms of the resources that were being allocated. Of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Academy being predominantly Black and Brown. And then following this, just the successes of the students from Martin Luther King Jr. Academy versus those of Willow Creek Academy, which is not a reflection of the students themselves, but just the resources as well as the staff turnover and retention. So I began exploring everything that was occurring there, and I didn't end up going forward to publish the piece. But from that, I was in conversation with one of my close friends, because I was looking for interviews, and she was like, oh, you know what? My dad actually works there. And I was like, no way. So together we started volunteering for the community garden, and it's just this beautiful space. Mm-hmm. It's so big. And during the school year, it's incredible because they have a science class, and in the science class, they use the soil from the garden to teach the kids, in the cooking classes that the eighth graders do, I believe. The kids also use the produce from the garden. And then here in the summertime, at the end of the week, they distribute bags of groceries from the garden. So it's just incredible how it's just self-sustaining, healthy, and just all these different aspects.
Yes. And we can all tell probably a child in a garden picking.
Exactly.
And there's
yeah.
To eat it when actually
work with
it, right?
Uh-huh, completely. And that was like one of the best parts, because usually when we go It's just a few of us there because of the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. But now it's been 3 times that I've come to interact with the same little girl. And her name is Amanda, and she's just so precious and so cute. So the first time she was like a little bit more shy. And then the second time she plopped down like right next to me as we're gardening. And I was like, hi. And she was like, hi. And I was like, so do you have a favorite type of vegetable? And she was like, I love carrots. And she just went on and on about how she wants to be a carrot farmer when she grows up.
Yeah.
and I was like, awesome. Like you can be a farmer. But it just goes to show that like, things as small as like community gardens, which are a labor of love, they really do have like an impact.
Absolutely.
And an influence in how these kids view the world and like their role and health.
Yes. And so much of the time in the last several decades or 100 years or so, you know, children of color or children with a little less income who live in the city, they don't see gardens. They see, you know, drugstores on the corner with Doritos.
And right.
It's just funny. So I love what you're painting, and I love knowing that that's happening in that little spot there.
Yeah. And then a little background. So I'm just going to piggyback off of what you said.
Sure.
So in Marin County earlier, when we were having members of my church also volunteer after I like started up, so I was looking up the statistics, and it's something like 1 in 5 faces food insecurity in Marin County.
Mm.
And that's something that oftentimes seems surprising to people because many pockets here are so affluent. But then again, like it is one of the most segregated places in the nation. So where food insecurity, or you can say food apartheid as like the sociological term outlines it, exists, is in communities like the Canal, which is a primary like Latino community, and Marin City and other places.
Yeah.
So it's really, So for me, it's just the more I've been learning, being like, wow, like these problems, these like inequities, they really do occur in like your own home when you're willing to like investigate and then lend your time.
Mm-hmm. And often they're simply hidden. They're not, they don't, you know, people aren't, it's not always good when you can see the problems, you know, but when you see them and then you expose, you know, what's happening and you can connect with people about what are the solutions, which you are doing, that's the thing. You mentioned, when we talked at one point, you mentioned social media and how it can be easy to become self-righteous, and you mentioned cancel culture. Now, some of these terms, you're 20 something years younger than me, so I'm probably not going to be up on some of these things. Can you say a little more about that, about the...
Of course.
Yeah,
so cancel culture, that's a terminology and concept. I think that's emerged more within the last 3 years or so of my life, and I'm 20 years old, going on 21. And so what it essentially is it works outside of like social justice and social justice warriors or activists, whatever you want to call it. But specifically when someone does something wrong, or just say like you tweeted something bad when you were like 14 years old, okay, then people will like uncover those old tweets and will be like, hey, like you did this, therefore like you're canceled. And so they'll use that like one act to speak to your entire character. And so something that I've learned in engaging with this culture and just seeing how it unfolds is that cancel culture, there's an aspect to it that's valid, which is one, this like call in to accountability, right? So you can use cancel culture overarching to just call people into conversation, and you don't necessarily have to do that publicly, you know?
Right.
But just pulling them aside and being like, hey, can we like address what you did and the harm that like this caused? But with that, when you're not able to do that and you're just publicly calling someone in just for the purpose of then like canceling them, it's not allowing you to see the person as a holistic being capable of growth.
No. You could have seen something 10 years ago that you grew dramatically from.
Exactly.
To address the person today. We want the person who's grown. We don't need to go back to the past, right? We can go back to learning. And what, when you said this, what were you saying, you know?
Mm-hmm. Learn. Yeah. And so then this like speaks to something like bigger in terms of activism today, because a lot more like dialogue is being normalized on what a future grounded in restorative justice would look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what is integral to restorative justice is having these honest conversations between the perpetrator and the survivor or victim,
mm-hmm.
Whatever harm was caused by that perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And so having this conversation where it's like, okay, here's the harm that you caused. How are we going to like adjust from it? And then how are we going to promote healing in both of these people?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have that call into accountability within it, but it's understanding that people aren't disposable. And I think that's the point that I want to hone in. Like, people are not disposable, and that's part of moving in radical love, mm-hmm. is understanding that love is transformational. Having the humility to have these conversations is transformational.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that, having that integral amount of accountability, and then what comes from that.
Yes, absolutely. I want to share a piece around this, and that is, you know, I just love and celebrate what you're about, how you show up. You know, I have for years now being in your family. And as I look at a concept I'm really passionate about, which is village. Mm-hmm. So like co-housing, you know what co-housing is?
Right, yeah.
Village, mm-hmm. and community. To me, that's natural. Mm-hmm. And the way we live today is not. It's actually not natural.
Right.
Not healthy.
It's not.
And I'm working to get out of it. However, I will say, for me, Sweet Sage, it took, I don't mean to belittle, you're sweet and you're lots of other awesome things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took going through 13 months of postpartum depression when mm-hmm. I actually felt this word village tattooed across my forehead, literally. It was energetic. Mm-hmm. I did not actually get a tattoo on my forehead. So I got really engaged. Well, I'm engaged like you, and I have been, you know. And as I brought people together, what I noticed is the main fear was not, I'll just go straight to what it was. It was, I don't want to be close to you. I don't want to have to mm-hmm. argue with you. We're going to get into arguments. I don't want to have to.
Right.
The
yeah.
Conflict. And honey,
yes.
I was raised with that. So, and I suffered from it, and I've learned from it. But
right.
I just want to say in this moment, you know, as you say, people are not disposable. No, and conflict is actually human, and it's normal, mm-hmm. it's healthy, but we can sort through it. And when I look at you in the face, even if you did something atrocious to my daughter or my dad or whatever, I can love you because we can get over mm-hmm. it together. You're not disposable. So I love what you're sharing about that.
Yeah. And I think you really, like, I just have to jump onto that. You hit it like right on the head, because I do think as we've like moved into these, you know, well, one, it's like a culture of just being independent and then valuing individualism, right? And so it shies away from community, but I think it also, it so clearly affects our ability to have these hard conversations when conflict does arise.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I've been really learning about a lot about myself and my family and how we handle conflict when it emerges.
Yeah.
But even it was like 2 weeks ago where me and my friend, we had like a hard moment, but both of us are just like so mindful yeah. about just growth. And that's the amazing thing I can say about like my friendships, is all of us are on that pathway of like, we're really committed to like growth, you know? And so when it all occurred, we really like hit it on the head, like we hashed it out. And I was like, you know, here's how this harmed me. And then vice versa, like she said it, but it was not one of us getting up and being like, no, I'm not going to have this conversation, or like, no, we're going to put this off,
yeah.
which I do understand sometimes, you know, you need to take a step back.
Yeah.
But both of us were in the space where it's like, this is doable. And because we were able to have that hard conversation, we were able to just like move past it, you know,
oh.
and stronger for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's just the ability to like sit down, have the hard conversation, like buckle in, and then really ask like honest questions of like, why are you like feeling that, or where is that coming from? You know?
Yeah.
Active listening.
Listening. And there's big stuff here too, like that most 20-year-olds don't actually have. And that's not a judgment on their who they are. It's simply they've had different exposures and experiences and teachings. But yeah, conflict is something that is actually, I'm at this point in my life, you know, I'm a masterful communicator. I can deal with conflict well. It's actually a wonderful thing. It is so enlightening, conflict, to point out mm-hmm. what matters to us, what doesn't. Do we take things personally still, or can we move past that, et cetera? Where is it hard for us to, oh, it's beautiful. So mm-hmm. I do thank you, Sage, for being committed. And I love the picture you just painted of your friends.
Yeah.
Together. It's awesome. What mm-hmm. Would you say led you, being from Marin, from a county that's very financially affluent, what led you mm-hmm. to be engaged in social justice?
Right. So, I think one of the shaping moments was one of my youth pastors, Phil, and his wife, Mindy. And so it's about when I had just come to like that new church, and he talked about this idea of compassion, and he outlined the root of the word, which is compati. I don't know how you pronounce it. But what that root of the word means is to suffer with. And so he just painted this picture of how when you have compassion, when you have love, it means that you're suffering with the people who are enduring the harm that's being inflicted upon them. And so from that, I was like, you know what? Like, I am naturally a very like compassionate and empathetic person. And I was like, so I want my compassion to be integral to me, but also integral to how I hold space and like move in this world. Rooted in action, right? And so that just led me on this big journey of growth. And in high school, my friend and I, we started a small nonprofit, which is 501c3 certified. And it was called Free Beauty. So our mission statement was combating child slavery in the cosmetics industry. And so from there, we are able to hold fundraisers. Our first fundraiser was a fun run, and I was 15, like calling to get insurance and permits. So it was definitely like crazy town, but it was amazing how it all came together because of our like community. So people volunteered. Of course, my mom was so integral to just guidance, and also encouragement, just being like, Sage, you can do this. Like, you're capable. So do it. And we did it. With so much of like their help. So we had that fundraiser. We also presented at the Worldwide Women's Festival. There are different layers of like that time in my life, which was in high school. And then with that, I then ended up going to Westmont College, and that was the hardest year of my life. Speaking honestly, like it still brings tears because it was just really heavy. And so I went there, and that was the first time I really had to wrestle with my faith and make sure that it's mine and not dependent on the church.
Beautiful.
And so, yeah. And so what I saw when I saw Westmont was a school that was very grounded in its ways, one of which is the institutionalized racism at Westmont is so tangible, mm-hmm. From everything within the conversations that takes place within students, like the microaggressions, blatant racism, and then also the staff, many different levels, like which occurred, in that, like, we so witnessed. And so within my friend group, when I went to Westmont, I started off with a group of friends, and where like tensions arose was over, like, there's no other way to like put it, but racist behavior.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's where like tensions arose. And so from that, I did have friends who were people of color, and it was just heartbreaking because my two Black friends at Westmont, they both ended up dropping out and switching schools just because the environment was so bad. My friend Vanessa, who's Filipina, she also dropped out. It was pretty much just the retention rate is so low. And it wasn't only like speaking to my experiences and what I witnessed, but an article just came out on Westmont. And there was also a slide showing their like retention rates of students of color. And it's very dismal, and it's because of the environment that goes unchecked. Mm. And so with that, where the critical turning point occurred is I was like, I am so blessed because I have this white privilege, which comes from like my whiteness. And then with that, I have this layer of my identity, which is being Puerto Rican. And so from that, what my mom has instilled from that, from our side of the family, is the hard work ethic, just the community and love and warmth, you know? And so I was like, I need to learn to balance these like two sides of my identity, and recognize how I myself can be a catalyst. And so how this all ended up coming to heads was later in the school year, I was planning a visual display and walkout, which was recognizing gun violence in the U.S., which is also inherently tied to race. And I was called into like a series of meetings with staff, which didn't go well. And that was another thing that was like really disheartening, because I was like, here's the opportunity for us to have this honest conversation and transparency about how we want to move, how we want to challenge like these like norms of like violence in our country. But there wasn't the space to do that. And so coming out of those conversations in that year, I was really like depressed. And just really had to like think about how I was going to use this to move forward. Yeah. But one thing that came from it was there's this like one speaker, and it was really funny because initially the day we were going to hold the walkout was when that speaker would have come. And so we ended up switching the day. And so the speaker who came, she was a Black woman, an activist that groups from Westmont had strictly like really advocated for her to come. And so in her sermon, she said, "Through my suffering, like God has revealed his glory." And that was just something like I wrote down in my journal real quick, because I journal pretty much every week. And so that line just like stuck to me, you know? And now that's how like I've truly like seen it just come to fruition. Because before Westmont, like I never had to think about my racial identity, because it was never called into question and it was never otherized by people in conversation and how they like treat me. But because of Westmont, like I did have to look at myself, look at what my identity like means to me, and then how I can use it to create like a better future and a better world that's inclusive for like all people, right? And so then that's really, that was, you know, the sparking point that led me on a journey of exploring racial justice, specifically racial equity. And so when you look at racial equity, it ties into so many different issues and social problems that we see in our community. So for example, like the achievement gap, or the educational gap, which my family was talking about the other day. So race so closely ties into every aspect of life, because of different things that have emerged from slavery, whether it be like generational wealth, and different things like that. So yeah, so all of that at Westmont, that's really what got me here. And so for it, it was really hard, but I made it. So I'm really proud of myself. Oh. And then now I just applied to a racial equity board in Marin County. And so who's to say if I'll get on, but it's just to say that like I'm here and I'm moving forward with what that year placed upon me and the calling that like God put on me.
Yeah. Wow. That was a lot, and a big, beautiful share that I wasn't aware of what happened with you in your college year with the wrestling with your faith and the work with the gun violence and all that. Gosh. Yeah. Deep, deep respect for you for, you know, going through that and coming out and deciding that you're going to be engaged and you're going to help out. And, you know, mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, I lived in Marin, but only till I was 13. And it's something that kids who grow up in a lot of privilege, which Marin County is a lot of privilege, we have a different reality, right? When we get out and we need to see the quote unquote real world or some more of the suffering that people go through, you know, it's it can be really, really heart shattering and dramatic, because when you're raised with a lot of love and you don't get to see some of the rest of the pain of the world, you know, it can be very shocking. And it sounds like you took a healthy approach. And one day I'll share with you the story of my experience, which was very, very, very similar in college. When my world shattered and I realized, oh my gosh, there are things that happened that I didn't learn about as a child.
Right.
And I'd be engaged. And that was around river conservation. I didn't know we built dams, but we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really not smart. So yeah, I hear you. It's beautiful that you're doing the work. And I wonder, you know, when you think about other people, you know, I don't know how many other 20-year-olds there are in the country, but there are millions and millions and millions. Some of them have really good lives. You know, they have good parents like you, and they're smart and they're engaged and all that. Many of them don't. And I wonder, what would you say to them that may inspire others, you know, your age, to help them live a better life?
Mm-hmm. Oh. That's a tricky one.
And
I think, Yeah, because like you said, like I have these wonderful parents who have like fostered this in me, you know? But I mean, I think the first like stepping stone I would say, which of course it's harder than said, is to like find your community. Just like find your people, whether that's a few people, because it doesn't have to be, you know, family, of course, isn't blood. So just like finding your community, like we like talked about earlier, and leaning into that community, because those will be the people who challenge you, who also like mentor you, who guide you inherently. Because I really do think that's what like strong friendships do, you know? It's just a mutual exchange. And then in terms of just like leading a better life, for me, and I guess asking people to do the same, just examining, like, you know, despite ways that like you have suffered, because of course all sufferings of like different levels are valid, right? But just identifying still like, yes, I've suffered, but what like remaining privileges like do I have, you know? And then how can I like use those to step in and help other people? So I think it's just, you know, I would say like starting by identifying those like small areas, however small they are, and then being intentional with what you do. So I guess, yeah, now I'm like breaking it down, because this is a question that I didn't think on as much. But just living with intentionality, I think that's what I would break it down to. And I do that like through different ways of just journaling, and then also having conversations that are very reflectional, like with my friends. So just identifying parts of myself where I'm like, you know, I don't think I really like this about myself, or I feel like I'm like moving into like the wrong space, you know, and then rebalancing, and then being intentional about how I take on the next day or take on the next moment to make sure that it's uplifting myself and uplifting others with me through that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you also, you know, you do have a lovely mother and father, and they're not perfect. Nobody's perfect in that way, in the human way.
Yeah.
And you don't, you know, there are a lot of people who 20 years old, they came out of a house where they were not treated well, and still they have to heal a lot of stuff, and a lot of people can come out of that and be actually really amazing people.
Yeah, 100%.
So yeah. Tell me, sweetheart, one more piece I'd love to hear from you, and that is, what is your vision for the future? You are definitely an engaged person. You've seen mm-hmm. a lot more now than you had 2 or 3 years ago. You work in San Francisco, you know. What is your vision for the future, or what are some elements of it?
Right. I love this question. And it's so funny because it can like take place on so many different levels, right? Like yeah. it can be the world level, micro level, just me. So my vision like for myself and my community is definitely always shifting. Like when I was younger, I was definitely like, I'm going to do this as a job, you know? And now I realize that I really have no clue what I want to do for a job, but I'm like, that's completely okay with me because there's these parts of me that are like integral to me, like being an educator, which I was talking about. Because educating people, that's just like sharing my passion naturally, right? Whether it be through like writing or going into a teaching profession, there's a million ways to be an educator in this world. So I think that's like the vision for me is just continuously growing, continuously like moving into like who I am and who like God created me to be. Mm-hmm. And then on that pathway, sharing it by being an educator on racial justice as well as social justice. And then on the bigger scale, in terms of like racial justice, like the vision for me is fostering restorative justice and what that will look like in the future. Mm. And so that means a lot of things, which sound crazy to people. So like, for example, like defunding the police, like that's come up into like mainstream conversation. So for me, it's saying like, I have this incredible imagination. That's like one thing that God gave to humans, which is like so unique. And so it's looking at the world and saying, you know, what isn't working? What was created out of oppression? And then how can we imagine a better system, a better future, that is inclusive and like fostering to the well-being of all people in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. And I do think that begins with restorative justice, and ties into abolishment of different systems, whether it's policing, whether it's the mass industrial prison complex, moving into this space that says no to disposability. Because I don't think that humans were created to be disposed of. Like we were created to live in community. Yeah. And that speaks to this aspect of radical love. Yes. So I think that's my future vision for this world is just like a world free of disposability in whatever that looks like.
So beautiful, dear. Thank you so much for your vision, for your engagement, for your, frankly, to keep it simple, your smile. You are smiling so much of the time, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just started a new job and, you know, these guys that are leading us through this, you know, training and stuff, they smile a lot and do that. And I appreciate it so much about you.
I definitely do. It's the joy.
Wishing you so well, Sage, and thank you for your work. And again, listeners, the a reminder of the website for Sage's work, it's HTTP and then the lines and stuff, and it's accionlatina.org. Accion is A-C-C-I-O-N, latina.org. And thank you so much, listeners, for coming here, for hearing a little bit of uplifting stuff that you can take into your life and that you can take into the lives of people who you treasure. I encourage you to take it to elders, take it to people who are ignored, take it to people of color. So many people have less privilege than you have, and it's beautiful to share your love. So anybody you think who would enjoy this, just go ahead and share it with them. And yeah, these are our monthly interviews. This one will go up in August, and you can find them all on our website or my blog, whatever you want to call it. It's leaningintolight.com, and it's on our conversations page. And again, I'm Jessica Rios, the founder of Leaning Into Light, and we're not on social media right now, so please sign up for our newsletter, which comes out
once a month or so. And again, thanks so much, Sage, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yes.